Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the first part of a two-part special on Glastonbury Abbey's sphere of influence. You may remember this time last year we broadcast 1300 years of Glastonbury Abbey, and that was with Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder. Well, they're back for a second shot, and we'll be going to Shapwick, where Abbot Whiting lived. That's the manor house, also looking at the dovecot there, the almoner's house. Now, that was the money that was given to the poor by the abbey. The almoner was in charge of all that. And also visiting the Avalon Marshes Centre at West Hay, where there's been a recreation of the sort of building that was around before the abbey was built. But there was a monastic settlement there well beforehand in Anglo-Saxon times. Also, we'll be going to Mere to look at the fish house, which was a part of the abbey where fish were bred. And that is also on the Somerset Levels. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. To resume where we left off last year, 1300 years at Glastonbury Abbey, we now go to talk to Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder at Shapwick.
I'm Mark Hutchinson and I work at Glastonbury Abbey. And we're standing here at Shapwick, which we're going to look round, because it goes back here, the buildings, at least to the 700s, and we're going to be exploring that with my colleague, Luke.
Shapwick is in the middle of the Somerset Levels, pretty much. It's a place a lot of people may know, come down here for walking, bird watching, that sort of thing. But I mean, it doesn't sound to me, the Levels doesn't sound an ideal place to be living, really, because it's not easy to get around.
No, it's not. We've just experienced that. You'd had to come here by water, because where we've travelled today would have all been marshes. And as we stand here, looking from this, where this old manor house would have been, there would have been a moat just coming round here. And you can see out across the Levels for miles and miles to the sea. And originally the sea would have come in right up to here.
So we're about, what, 4 or 5 miles from Glastonbury?
Yes, would be about 4 or 5 miles, yes.
And okay, so this was a house, people were living here, but what was the connection with the abbey, if any?
Oh, well, the connection here was the land was given or acquired by the abbey, depending on how you want to feel about it. Back in the 700s, we have the earliest charter for the land here coming into Glastonbury about in the 700s. So there's been a connection. Shapwick, sheep, probably, because as you saw, sheep in the fields as we came across. So it's been slightly higher. We're talking of only metres higher, but it would have been dry. And that's we're dealing with minimal levels of height here, but just to keep our feet out of the wet.
Actually, if you drive around or bus around or walk around the Levels, Luke, you find there are actually quite a few places where, like West End Zoyland is one of them, which is now, it seems as if it's just part of the landscape, but back then it would have been an island, Western Zoyland.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're surrounded now by opposite Somerset Levels, as Mark's talked about, this kind of riverine, flooded, often in some cases saltwater marshed area. And interspaced amongst those would have been lots of little areas of slightly higher ground that formed miniature islands. And of course, islands and wetlands are an ideal place to find some kind of settlement on.
Well, and also I would have thought quite good for sheep as well. We heard about sheep, but you don't really want, and yes, there's quite a few we can see around here, if you're trying to grow crops, the Levels could be, if they get flooded. The thing is with the sheep, at least you can herd them and move them around as you need to.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know sheep herding has happened here since well, as far as we can go back, remember, and before. The good thing about some of these areas on the levels here for looking after sheep is that they're very much subject to seasonality. So in some seasons, the warmer seasons, the waters have receded slightly. You've got more land in which to graze on. So you've got summer grazing, and then you've got winter grazing. So you can bring your animals onto the island areas to graze in the winter. In the summer, when that grazing land in the winter has been depleted, you've got this new swathe of grazeland opened up as the waters recede a bit as well. So you've got this ideal area where you can kind of manage your animals throughout the winter on in the water.
Yes, so I mean, Luke's just been talking about the summer lands, you know, where the floods would recede, and this is why it's called Somerset, after the summer lands, where people would come down. And that's been happening for possibly on and off for perhaps towards 250,000 years.
So would it have been flooded in the winter and the land been exposed in the summer? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, oh, very, very
why
much.
Why is that? I mean, surely there's just as likely to be a flood in the summer.
Some areas dry in the summer, not all of them. I think it's linked into the idea of having a very large tidal range, and also about the environment and the amount of groundwater in different seasons. So of course we're really close in the Somerset Levels to the aquifer here, so I'm on the Somerset Levels, you're pretty much on the aquifer, so you know that you've got not much room in the wetter seasons. All it takes is a couple of millimetres of rain to flood an area.
If you want to reach the aquifer, you stick a screwdriver in the ground and there it is.
Literally, I mean, I'm sure we can literally go to a field just over there and do that now if you want to. Yeah.
A bit like Holland, of course, but also I suppose people here would have been doing other things other than sheep. What was this house here about? What were the people here, what would they have been doing?
So the house here is actually part of, well, obviously what we're looking at now is a much later house built in the post-medieval period here, but its core at its centre is part of a medieval dwelling, a medieval manor. And part of that manor's job was basically to serve as part of an administrative hub and a place for people to stay, primarily from the abbey. So
yes, the abbot would have escaped here from the rigours of his job. Of course, Whiting, I think, was arrested here, wasn't he? So this is where the soldiers and people came to arrest Whiting.
So had he come here to hide?
Well, probably, or possibly, but it was also one of his sort of weekend retreats. Yeah. So, I mean, if you think of all these people who have sort of weekend houses in Cornwall these days, this is a medieval sort of holiday let.
Crikey, so imagine the soldiers turning up here, the hooves of the, you know, you could hear the hooves on the cobblestones or on the ground of the soldiers turning up. Just take us through that arrest, because he was the last abbot. I think we need to say something about Richard, because he was resisting, wasn't he, Henry VIII's dissolution?
Oh, tremendously. Well, there's a lot of discussion about it. I mean, there's some people who put forward the theory that actually Henry VIII really liked him and that he didn't really want this to happen. I don't know where the evidence for that is. I mean, Henry VIII by this time would have been really devoured by syphilis. He was very, very unwell. And I think other people were really running the country. And it was those people, possibly the Seymours and others, who were actually the instigators of this sort of dissolution.
There was a lot of money being made, wasn't there, by the wealthy in the country from the dissolution as well?
Oh, yes, huge amounts. And that's always been the case when human beings have been around. There's always someone wanting to make a quick buck. And so the soldiers would have come here. Abbot Whiting, we don't really know why he came here. Possibly he was a very strong man. And I don't think, in my opinion, and I may be wrong, he was hiding. I think he was actually resting because he was old. He was ill. And he was unwell, and so he was here with his people, in marches these people to question and take him to the Tower of London. Wow, I mean, crumbs!
Well, he puts himself in a position of kind of moral influence, doesn't he, an authority, by saying, "No, you've got to come to me. I'm not going to go to the Abbey and wait for you. I'm going to go to my retreat, and you've got to come and find me." And it puts him in that kind of slight moral high ground. Kind of, he's not hiding. They would have known where he was. And he would have known they were coming, very much so. So he's deliberately choosing almost to come here, I'd have thought. And whether this offers him an area as well where he's familiar with the manor, he's familiar with his serving staff here or whatever, and he can set his affairs in order and put things into motion that he needs to put in motion for a future trial or whatever may happen to him.
I mean, we think of Henry VIII as being the man behind the dissolution of the monasteries, but actually it was Thomas Cromwell. I'm not sure if he was his chief minister or he was certainly commissioned to get rid of the monasteries. Can you say something about Thomas, who he was, and a bit of his background?
Well, Thomas Cromwell, I mean, there's lots of books and things about Thomas Cromwell now trying to get inside him. These are all people's opinions, of course. But, I mean, he was a very, very important man. He'd risen from nothing, really, to being the most important person in government in the country.
Yeah, he'd been working with the Italian merchants and things over the years. And the other thing, to put this all in context, is that the abbeys and the monasteries were doing an incredibly important role in society. I mean, throughout the country, right, obviously right up to Scotland, etc., in doing things like looking after the sick in their infirmaries and giving alms to the poor, things like that. And there was, by the time Whiting was arrested, there was groups of monks going around the country homeless. You know, people who didn't have anywhere to go, and people were looking and saying, these are the guys that looked after us, these are the guys that gave us a little bit of money when we had nothing. Yes. And now they have been evicted. They're almost like renegades in their own country.
Well, Luke's said about the richness of the land here, and you've just spoken about arms. We're going in a little while to where the almoner had a big estate here. Although the abbot's estate here was much bigger, but the almoner's estate, which really supplied money, we're going to go and see that and feel the sort of wealth of that, and that will enable money to come in for the almoner, hopefully, and I say hopefully, to distribute to those in need, but perhaps, like all human beings, sometimes it didn't end up where it should have done.
Yeah. No, I think definitely there is this case, like you're saying, about the monasteries, almost in their charter and by dint of what they are, they're the kind of foundation doctrine. It's the rule of St. Benedict, and this obligation for them to look after the poor and the sick.
Who is this guy Benedict who sort of founded the idea, the Benedictine order?
Benedictine order. Well, he's now a saint, but he was a. He was a monk who was living sort of present-day Italy, in Monte Cassino, and he wrote his rule of St. Benedict down there, kind of set out a structure, how he believed people under holy orders or within a holy life should lead their lives. And this became very popular because prior to that point, we don't really have many forms of structuralized religion in this sense. Monasteries are monasteries, and people, or the monks or holy people in those institutions, kind of follow the way of life they believe is best. But the rule of St. Benedict added a structure that was kind of very quickly adopted throughout Southern Europe and slowly marches up through Europe until it reaches England, a little bit later on, a couple of hundred years later. But it very much was a way of formalising this idea of this religious life and way. Anyway.
So he's bringing a bit of order to what had just people had started doing something that they wanted to do, so they thought it was the right thing to do, and he brought some structure to it.
If you see our backs towards the Bristol Channel,
right,
we're looking towards Shepton Mallet. From the area of Shepton Mallet come three fingers of land. The very high land, which is the Mendip, goes, Bath, Bristol. And then we're stood on this little down a bit from this finger of land that comes from Glastonbury down to Wedmore. And then to our right is a higher finger of land, which are the Polden Hills. And those are the three high bits of ground that sort of transverse the marshes here, and which were the ways in which people walked and moved along with boat, of course, but they were the highland where people lived.
So where are we in comparison to those?
Well, we're just off the middle finger of highland ground that comes from Glastonbury down through Wedmore, And so we're standing here. The marshes would have been out there. There would have been a moat. This would have been a defended place because, you know, a moat is defensive. And you can actually see the remains of the moat down there. And then there would have been a ha-ha there. Ha-has were really popular for posh people, the rich. And they were just dug out so that you wouldn't see a fence. So when you were sitting in your manor, you could have this view across miles of land. But what there was actually a ditch which would stop the animals getting in. And ha-has were very popular. And there's a ha-ha here, along with behind us this magnificent dovecot. And you don't get many dovecots of this size anywhere in Britain.
Well, let's have a look at the dovecot first, and then we'll maybe have a look at the manor house. A tiny little door around the back.
Yes,
that is enormous. My God!
Yeah. But you can now see the thousand. There's over 1,000 bird holes here for the pigeons, and you can see them from this side.
Incredible.
Absolutely amazing, really. Mm-hmm. And so there would have been just 1,000 holes, and goodness knows how many birds, because there would have been more than there were holes, I would guess. But do remember, this was for feeding people.
Mm.
This was live food. We had no fridges or freezers. There was no dried pasta. There were no tins of baked beans. When people suddenly arrived, I mean, the abbot would suddenly arrive, and they would have to sort of provide food and for his guests. And so pigeon here would have been marvellous.
They got these little nesting squares with a tiny little bit for the pigeon to perch before he flies up to the top and out, but the rest of it was all completely defended from predators, from foxes.
Yes.
Or whatever. Now 1,000, you say. Now I'm just looking at, we've got, it's basically inside here, it's octagonal. Is that octagonal? Yeah, it is octagonal.
Yes.
We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 holes wide. How deep is that? Now it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
About 40 or plus. I don't know.
Yes.
I've lost count.
Yes. But it's a hell of a lot. Anyway, so what? How would the pigeons here as food? How would they have been distributed, and where to? Do you think?
It primarily would have been, well, as Mark said, if the abbot arrives, it would have been to the abbot, his men, possibly rich visitors who are coming with him. The pigeons here wouldn't necessarily have been food for the poor here or for the lowly classes. This is definitely for the upper classes. And of course, you're also after eggs and things like that as well from them. You're not just going to eat the birds themselves. But they're a massive part of the higher status medieval diet. And of course, you can tell it's kind of high status in mind because of the sheer scale of the dovecot. Now, normally medieval dovecots, they don't, not many survive in England because they were usually timber structures, either as lean-tos on the side of buildings and building gables, or they're a lot smaller. In this one here, we've got, to be honest, a fairly huge dovecot that's massively constructed out of stonework.
So, I mean, this is what, 20 foot tall, is this? You
yes.
know, I mean, it's massive.
It is. It's
I mean, this is showing, I mean, it's oozing wealth in stone and pigeons. I mean, if you think today, who eats pigeon today? Fine dining. If you go fine dining, you tend to find various sorts of lovely little sort of pigeon things on the menu. You don't go into your sort of burger bars and find pigeon. So I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that pigeon is still fine dining. Mm.
So when would this have been built, this place?
What we're looking at here now is a little bit later than the early manor built here in the 1100s was the sort of really first big manor here. There would have been a pigeon loft here, a dovecot. The one we're going to see next is older, but we can't get inside it.
Okay, thank goodness.
I mean, you look at this blue lias stone. It has seams, and you can see it sort of splits easily into lovely slabs that comes from over towards Street. And then we have this sort of Dulcot's sandstone.
I think it could probably still last another few hundred years, this place.
You see,
but we don't know what year it was, do we?
This here has been rebuilt. This is more sort of probably 18th century, so 1700s rather than medieval. But there was a medieval one here. And which parts sort of go back? I mean, if you begin to look at the foundations are very different to the upper.
Yeah.
And so it's probably been built on the foundations of a much older one, because the stonework there is very, very different.
Let's go over to have a look at the manor house itself now. So tell us a little bit about what this... Abbot Whiting was arrested here, but what would the manor, even though what we're looking at is not the original manor, what would the manor have been, the purpose of it being at the time, do you think?
The purpose... The Abbot of Whiting had numerous manors, because that's the way in which they influence. What we're looking at here is the wider influence of Glastonbury. It wasn't just in Glastonbury. It was over vast areas of countryside and affected numerous communities. And so the effect was here that he was lord of the manor, and therefore not just in Glastonbury, but the people around Shapwick here had to obey and carry out the commands from the abbot here as lord of the manor. And so his influence then stretches to numerous manors round about. So there would have been a grand house like this. So as we're looking at this, this is a grand porch in the middle with two wings either side. And quite honestly, in medieval times, it would have been almost a similar sort of thing. A grand porch and two wings either side. There would have been a private chapel for the abbot here somewhere. Where it's gone, we don't know.
So I imagine this probably would have been sold off with the dissolution. Someone would have bought this or whatever, off of the king, probably. So as I understand it, the king took over everything and then sold it off to his mates.
Yeah, so the king, it kind of all devolved to the crown, arguably, and then from there it was.
Well, that was handy, wasn't it? Because the abbey and all of its land were worth an absolute fortune in those days.
A huge amount of money. You know, hundreds of millions of pounds today. But the idea that it does devolve to the crown, but almost after the dissolution, some of that money is used by the crown itself, but a lot of it is used as political currency to curry favour at court. So we get the idea that the land is almost sold off at knockdown rates to people to curry favour with them.
Right, so the people that Henry needs to get on side, he might say, give them this manor, for example.
Absolutely. And there's a fair bit of political manoeuvring around the dissolution about who can get the biggest slice of the pie and what bits of the pie they can grab. We know that, for example, a lot of the land of the abbey itself went to Edward Seymour, his future brother-in-law. And this is, of course, we don't quite know exactly, I don't think, how much he paid for land or whether he paid for the land at all, but he ends up administering a lot of the lands of the abbey as the Duke of Somerset, of course, in this area. So yeah, it really is kind of partitioned off for political favour almost.
Right, what about this building today? What's it used for?
Today it's actually a hotel, or you can hire it for a few days for parties. It's quite a sort of lovely place to come, and that's what they do, particularly at weekends. That's why we have to record here today, because at weekends they would tend to have guests occupying the many rooms here.
But it's got its own little church, I think, hasn't it? I mean, I suppose most manors would have had some sort of church or chapel of some kind, but that's much more recent.
The whole of what we're looking at on the exterior, the interior still has some of the ancient bits in there. Yes, well, we've just come literally a few hundred metres from where we were now to what was the almoner's house. Would have been like a manor house. There would have been a big tithe barn here. Behind us is a much earlier dovecot, which was built in the 1100s and then sort of redesigned, of course, over time. So this is the hub for where all the tithes came for the almoner, who then you would use that money for giving, looking after the poor.
So was he the abbey's treasurer?
No, he wasn't the abbey's treasurer. Each department in the abbey had their own funding, and so they would have churches or estates from which the tithes would come to fund their amount and the work they had to do. So the chamberlain would have some, the cellarer would have others, areas of funding. So they all had their own areas of funding.
So this was a church tax, basically?
Absolutely. And that tax was on top of the king's tax, on top of the papal tax. I mean, you almost had to, were taxed on breathing. I mean, if you were baptism was important for everyone, so people were taxed on that. So they had to pay the church for death and burial and marriage. You had to pay for everything. And then when someone died, you had to pay out your best crops or your best animal to the landlord. He would take that. So it was just horrendous.
So do you think it's coincidence that the abbot, when he was arrested, was actually down here, maybe trying to sort out affairs with the almoner? I mean, what was the relationship between the abbot? Because obviously this is one of the centres of finance for the abbey.
Oh, definitely. But, I mean, one of dozens of others. I mean, this is...
it's the way of devolving administration, you know, or compartmentalising administration. So what you do is you've got these vast estates. They'll be partitioned down into large estates, and then the administrators of those estates will then partition down into smaller estates. So the idea is you then don't have to have one person in charge of massive swathes of land, which is an absolute nightmare logistically. You give little parcels of this out to individual people to run on their own, and then they'll kind of feed some of that money into the greater whole, which is Glastonbury Abbey or Glastonbury. So the idea is having these little estates, as Mark said, there'd be many of these around. This would be just one amongst many. This is just one estate on the estate of Shapwick.
So what about the almoner here? How much would he have been gathering money from? Where would he have been gathering money from? And what sort of thing would he be going towards? Where would he be spending it on?
Well, being an almoner, in terms of the money gathered here and the amount of land he had, we're really talking kind of maybe a couple of, in terms of land, a couple of square miles he has here, in terms of acreage. And all of that money would be going towards either alms for the poor, supporting hospices, paying for... putting money aside for disaster and strife or problems, and various things like that. So it's kind of your charity wing of the abbey almost, or your contingency funds for the population in the areas.
So what happens at dissolution? Does that all just dissolve? Does it disappear?
Well, again, a large amount of it does just go. I mean, we see after the dissolution, wealthy groups of individuals in population centres like cities having to band together to fund private hospitals, because the problems get so bad, they actually notice, oh, this is really getting bad, we need to do something about it. The state or the abbeys aren't doing anything about it. So you end up having this almost individually motivated, charitable care come along afterwards. I suppose modern capacity might be as if you just got rid of your NHS completely overnight and then left the country for 5 years to figure out how it's going to run on its own, and that'd be the kind of...
But it wasn't just the NHS, it was social services and all the education as well. I mean, it was a real social crisis, and we forget.
These guys could read and write, for example, at the Abbey, couldn't they? And most people couldn't.
That was a privilege. And do remember the almoner, from the tithes here that would have come into the big tithe barn, and you've seen lots of tithe barns, would have been, he'd need staff. So the money would have to pay, I don't know what staff he had, but I mean, he would have had a good number of staff to run all this.
So do we know what happened here afterwards?
Yes, we do. This was all sold off at the dissolution. You can see a grand manor house, the outside. This is later than the medieval, but it gives you an idea. It's very attractive with a long building with some very interesting bits coming out of it to make it look very attractive. These peaked, I don't know what you would call them. How would you describe those sort of peaked bits coming out?
Oh, it's gabled. Gablings on the roof. Yeah, these kind of beautiful things.
Well, this I would imagine is about sort of 200-300 years old, is it, something like that?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is hundreds of years old.
But there would have been something similar here before.
Yes, absolutely.
And so who took it over, do we know?
Yes, we do. So we know that after the dissolution here, John Berkeley bought a 50-year lease of this. It was called a rectory then, and that's what happened. So then we've got the lists of all the sorts of people where it passed to, and then it's become not just the rectory, but it's now called the manor, whereas where we were a little while ago at Chapwick Hotel should have been called the manor. This here was actually the rectory, and now is a school, and a very, very wonderful school too. This is very different. This is around Dovecot, with a beautiful circular roof on top going up to a hole where the birds would have come in. So inside...
There's one just came out just right then. Right. So this one is much more used.
There wouldn't have been a window in medieval times. This was sort of put in later, because if you look up to the pinnacle up there, you can see the pigeons now sitting on there, and you can see where the holes would have been, where they would have gone in, which was similar to the ones that we saw at the last...
Yeah, so the very, very top of the Dovecot, right at the pinnacle, that's where they go in and out, yeah. And then they find themselves somewhere in there. But here we've got a window cut in for the that's what they're using now.
Yes, they're using that, and that's why the school actually locks it, because if you go in there, it's just full of pigeon watsits, which isn't too pleasant. So you can see that it's been rebuilt. As we're looking here, you can see the difference in the stonework, some of the more original stonework and some of the sort of newer stonework. But this whole thing is genuine and goes back to the 1200s. We know when the first Dovecot here was to be built. So this was to supply food for the almoner, not the abbot. And you noticed, of course, when we were at the abbot's dovecot, it was twice the size of this. This only has hundreds of nesting places for pigeons and doves, whereas the abbot's had over 1,000.
Again, but it shows that these estates, I talked about estate administration having almost estates within estates, and you can see that here with the idea of even of the dovecots. You've got kind of the big dovecot on the big estate, and then you've got this estate which is basically a mini estate on the abbot's estate, and it's almost a carbon copied estate in miniature. It's this idea of this devolved concentration of power, basically.
These were really important, weren't they, the dovecots? It seems like that was a major source of food.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, as we talked about in the other dovecot, the idea that this is a larder, basically, of fresh food. You know, food preservation is very, very difficult at that point.
And this so is the children in the school getting pigeon for lunch here?
Well, I don't know if that would go down very well, but you never know.
But when you think of the crop failures that they had in medieval times, so animals like this, birds, were a really, really useful source of food for the rich. I mean, the poor starved and died in their thousands. But, of course, the rich managed to survive. And this was a very sort of important... You can see the difference, really. You look beyond the dovecot here, you can see Chapwick Church. Our eyes move north from the church, and we then see this grand medieval house would have been here, which was the almoner's residence. And then as we eyes go down further north and we slope down towards the marshes, we then get a glimpse of where we were, that huge manor house of the abbot with the huge dovecot, you know, everything of a much bigger and grander style. This is about status. This is about who's in charge. This is about impressing who I am. And if you're coming here, you've got to feel a little bit smaller than you thought you were.
I would say it's worth noting that the almoner's manor here shared some of its, a small portion of its rents and incomes with the rector of the church. Although it did supply for the almoner himself and his duties, it also had to supply the upkeep for the local rector and the upkeep of the local church here as well. So this is an idea of that allowing bodies like the local church of Shatwick to be a self-sufficient entity without them constantly having to go to Glastonbury Abbey saying, we need money for this, we need money for that. They've already allowed for that in their budgeting.
What you're saying, it does, you get the idea that the superstructure of the church, whether that's abbeys or the more public cathedrals and parish churches, was actually, in those days, before the dissolution, was almost like the superstructure of the country. And the king and the government was something sort of a bit distant and far away.
Well, it's almost its own government system, its own kind of self-governing entity within the country. And I think that in my opinion, plays a large way into the idea of the dissolution later on. If you ignore any kind of religious aspects, and if you ignore some of the more romanticised aspects of Henry wanting a new wife and a son, if you look at the idea of it being about power, money and prestige, you've got the monarch of a country who's becoming, as the church is gaining in power, increasingly isolated from the control of the government, increasingly isolated from the control of large swathes of estates and lands within the country. I believe it's about a third of is it just under a third of England is owned by the monasteries, yes, at the time of the dissolution?
More than the king. I mean, the religious system owns more land than the king in medieval times. That is, and here, Glastonbury Abbey, possibly around in excess of or about 270 square miles of land. That is vast. In Somerset and the Round.
So we're talking about the dissolution of the monasteries really marking, and I suppose the Reformation, which was going on at the same time, marking the end of medieval Britain.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's not long after that where you kind of get the period they, you know, call, you go on into the kind of, they call it the post-medieval period. As soon as you get the dissolution, happened, Henry VIII comes down, we get Elizabeth the First eventually on the throne after Mary. We kind of go straight into what modern scholars call the post-medieval period, and some people are now arguing that Henry VIII's reign is, you know, kind of, that is the end of the medieval world during his reign. And I certainly think there's a huge amount of cultural, political changes and shifts at this point, and the dissolution is part of that change and shift.
I think an important thing to point out is we hear the cars in the background and things, but there were no cars. the roads we've been along are so deformed that you've been bouncing up and down in your car, and
yes,
we've been stuck.
Over the levels, the roads seem to sink into the peat.
That's right.
Especially with the lorries.
Yes. So the only transport, it was here, would have been probably by boat. Or the only other way would have been over dry land to come along from Glastonbury, down one of the fingers of land that I was talking to you about, the Polden Hills, and then just down into here. But probably the most direct route would have been water. Water transport was everything. You talked about lorries. Of course, we didn't have lorries. It was much easier to use water, all right, and boats and barges and the whole of Glastonbury Abbey. I mean, the abbot actually, I just only discovered last Friday that the abbot actually owned boats that were probably sailing out of Bristol and Bridgewater. So, I mean, there's a whole vast other area to look at it, its influence into Ireland and all sorts of other places into the Mediterranean.
So why would they need to trade? Was there any point? Surely they were supplying food, whatever goods, for the local people in Somerset.
Well, you've got to remember, you've got to look at it almost as an international business as well as a monastery. So we've got the idea that, first of all, you need to supply your monastery. So we have got a lot of the crops and resources coming to the monastery from the local land and local holdings. The problem is you've got things like the problems of the supply of fish, and we're going to talk about this at the fish house later on. Most of the fish would come from the Devon coastline, up Lyme, and a big estate around there. The Abbey would ship, you know, saltwater fish to the Abbey, and the Abbey's lands to supply with fish, because fish was a huge part of the medieval diet. We'll talk about the fish house later, but the reason the fish house is so big and impressive that we'll look at is because freshwater fish was more of a prestigious thing to eat because it was harder to farm and source. So we'll talk about that in a little while. But the idea that you've got to get fish here, and of course the Devonshire coast is a long way away, and even the Bristol Channel is a fair way away from us here. So that idea of barges and provisioning and trade. You've also got to look at the idea that you need, or you don't necessarily need, but a big part of the medieval diet was wine, various types of wine being shipped in from France. We've got furs. You need furs and leathers. A lot of those are shipped in from Southern Ireland. We've got a huge amount of fish coming down from Iceland at various times on the trade routes. You've got metalwork coming from Spain. You've got all sorts of different resources coming in, tapping into international trade routes into the area here. But
yeah, I mean, it's huge. I mean, it was trading in stone, in metal, in gold and silver. I mean, this is a trading empire. I mean, we think of Brexit, but then, of course, there wasn't anything that would stop us. And the Abbey had fingers in almost every pie across Europe and in Britain and in Ireland.
I would imagine one of the major exports from the Abbey would have been wool, though, wouldn't it? Sheep and wool.
Yes, wool, but also, I mean, for instance, I mean, I've just got here some of the food that was consumed in the Abbey in just 3 months, October to December. We're talking of 90 oxen, 3 cows, 1 bull, 144 sheep. Then there's calves, pigs, a hundredweight and a half of cheese. I mean, this is vast amounts of food, and you need to be able to trade everywhere to be able to supply the high status food, because remember, they were living like this is fine dining medieval style, and quite amazing.
It sounds like a sort of combination of a supermarket chain and B&Q.
absolutely. but it's interesting. I just want to take you back here, because as we're standing in Chapwick here, I'm wanting to take you back to the sort of 600s, when a very important person actually was murdered here. And there's a very interesting sort of little murder story that we need to think about. Indract was the son of a Welsh king. He was a very pious religious man, and he made pilgrimage to Rome, and he was coming back from Rome, and he stopped off at this very important site of Glastonbury. And he stayed here at Chapwick, so the history tells us, if it's accurate. The people of Chapwick saw that Indract, with his little bevy of men who were travelling with him, had very large purses and staffs with golden tops. Wow. So the village gossip got going, and they thought, these people looked stuffed with gold in their purses, and even their staves have shiny tops to them. So what happened is they got together, they went in, murdered a lot of Indract's supporters and pilgrims who had been to Rome, stole the purses, took the staves, and then just going out of Chapwick here, trying to escape, they realised that it wasn't what they thought. The purses were full of celery seeds that they'd picked up, because this was a local thing here. And the staves were not topped with gold, but brass. And so they were terribly disappointed and fled. So that's the interesting, embellished probably over history, but there may be a seed of truth that some murders happened right here where we're standing in Chapwick. So you've got a murder story there.
Well, it's a sanitary tale for any Somerset scallywags listening.
Yes, indeed. I think storytelling, I mean, that's the important thing. What we're trying to do here is tell the story so that people can enter into that, because it's an exciting story, it's an important story, it's a very eclectic story because it involves a lot of different things.
The other thing is you must the Abbey come across little records. I mean, you were talking about this, the oxen and whatever earlier on, little fragments of information which actually can tell you a fantastic amount about just a little snapshot, almost like a Polaroid of something from hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Oh, yes, yes. And we're finding that all the time. Luke and I, we bat this information around, and Luke's such a fantastic colleague. We can have these, and then he corrects me and guides me, and then, you know, we have discussions. But it was like just last Friday from Professor James Clark in Exeter. I was with him, and we found out that the Aberdones owned a boat, and could there be more that were licensed to him in Bristol? And Luke says about how Bridgewater was joined.
So yeah, we're saying Bridgewater, we found out that Bridgewater is at this point considered part of the Port of Bristol. So the Port of Bristol is larger than just the docks at Bristol. It extends all the way down the Bristol Channel, and many of the smaller ports and inlets along there are considered part of the administered Port of Bristol. So when something's registered at Bristol, does it mean it's actually at Bristol, or does it mean it's held closer to the Abbey at Bridgewater, which would make to me a lot more sense. But so just discussing and batting ideas back and forth.
Those that controlled the Port of Bristol didn't want people docking anywhere else, did they? They much like to know exactly where everybody was that was coming up the Bristol Channel.
Bit out of a get out of jail free clause here, and I'll let Mark here explain.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I found in going through some of the old charters, that actually we really got under the skin of Bristol, because all the important and wealthy people in Bristol, of course, controlled a lot of the trade, and they would then take their taxes and cuts. But do you know what? The king gave Glastonbury Abbey absolute tax-free, all right? And this is really Brexit thing, isn't it? Tax-free, all right, trade, so that you could then trade and not get taxed anyway. You didn't have to pay levies. You didn't have to do anything. So as the ordinary people were going through, they'd have to pay taxes at various stages and through ports. Glastonbury just sailed through, all right? That's your answer to Brexit.
Well, I imagine also that the Bristol merchants, the people like the merchant venturers who were sort of getting together in those days, 1497, wasn't it, Cabot's trip to America, they would have actually done quite well out of the dissolution here. Yeah. They would have seen Glastonbury Abbey as a bit of a competition.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the whole thing was fought, and Glastonbury Abbey made a lot of enemies. And when we're going to go in a little while to the fish house, you know, battles between Glastonbury and Wells, battles between Glastonbury and Bristol because of the money we were taking out of Bristol, this upset a lot of people.
It's really not a small amount of money either. And maybe a bit of clarification point to my idea of trade I was talking about and what we're going abroad for, is that it's not just supplying the Abbey. You've got to all the trade that's flowing through Bristol, flowing through the Bristol Channel ports and out into the Mediterranean or Ireland or wherever it's going. It's not just coming to the Abbey. It's supplying all of the estates. And as we mentioned, these estates are vast. It's hundreds and hundreds of square miles. In Somerset alone, 56,000 acres of land, a huge amount of land. And of course, these trading routes are supplying the needs for all of this land. So that must have been an absolute fortune in money that's being lost out by the Bristol authorities at the time. So you can well understand why different pockets of other organisations had a bit of an axe to grind at Glastonbury.
I mean, this is all about water, and water is so essential, not just for life, but for trading. And what we do have, and I only discovered that a little while ago, that we know about abbeys having to raise armies. And Luke knows about knights' fees and things, because we have the records of having to supply knights, men-at-arms and things for battles when the king... because there was no standing army. But I recently discovered that actually Glastonbury Abbey had to raise a navy. It was in 1319... Edward II, I think, was in battle with the Scots, up at Newcastle, and the Abbot of Glastonbury gets a missive from the king asking him to raise a flotilla of naval ships with men-at-arms, so these were battleships, if you like, to go and stop French traders resupplying Scotland and people up there. What is interesting is the the people there said, no, we've been taxed enough by the king. And when the abbot went down there to see and to seize the boats, there was only one boat there. So obviously information had leaked out. So it's not only from the cabinet office things leak out from or whatever it is, but certainly some fake news had got out and they arrived there and there was there were no boats.
So what about this idea of Glastonbury Abbey raising an army? That doesn't sound very Christian.
Well, no, but you've got to remember you're looking at the abbey more as a administrative, as we said before, an administrative centre here. Every kind of lord in England or high status landowner has an obligation to the king in terms of some form of service. Now, that service will either be administrative or it will be military. And this is where Mark mentioned the idea of knight's fees. Some of the land, we talked about devolving power and land. A knight's fee is usually a land grant given to a lord or a knight, usually a local.
So we usually use the word fee to talk about money, don't we?
Yeah,
but this is land.
This is land. This is so what you're doing is you're giving a parcel of land to a retainer, basically, who might be a knight, one of the knightly classes. And what they will do is they will administer that parcel of land for you. And in return, for them taking the revenues and rents from that land, they will provide you with a certain number of days a year of military service. And of course, these people, knights as they were, are having to, from that land, pay for horses, pay for armoured harnesses, their armour, they're paying for their weaponry, but they're also paying for men-at-arms or common soldiery to come with them. So they would have their own group of little retainers they've portioned off their land to. So the idea that you get this system of, a quite effective system of military ranking, in a sense, where if you need an army, the abbot can send out the word to all of his knights, arguably on the estates, or men with obligation on the estates, and suddenly he can raise an army of several hundred men within 24 hours who are obliged through the contract of their landholdings to come and support him. So it's that idea of kind of having an army. And it is very unusual, I know, your original question of having a monastery with a standing army, but you have to remember this isn't anything unusual. You've got to think of the massive armies of the Papal States in Rome, for example, and this idea that at the time, although it might fly in the face of what modern people's sensibility about Christianity and religion are, at the time this is part and parcel of the control of the church, you know, the control of land, and what they thought the furtherment of the church's aims and ambitions.
That was Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder there at Chapwick, where the abbot lived and where Abbot Whiting was arrested in 1539, bringing the medieval period to an end, which is effectively what the dissolution of the monasteries did, a very different world before and after that. That was Whiting was executed by Thomas Cromwell under orders from Henry VIII back in 1539. So we leave it there for the time being. We'll be back next week to go to the Avalon Marshes Centre at West Hay, where there's a brand new reconstruction of a building that would have been on the site of Glastonbury Abbey before the abbey itself was built after the Norman invasion, because it started as a religious site much before that, during the Anglo-Saxon period. And we'll be going to visit next week Mere and the Fish House, which is where fish were bred for the use of the abbey too. So that's next week. More from Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder, the second in our two-part special on the Glastonbury Abbey sphere of influence.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder, for part one of our two-part special on Glastonbury Abbey's sphere of influence in medieval times, before Abbot Whiting was executed by Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell in 1539, bringing the medieval period to an end, as the dissolution of the monasteries did. Also, thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. If you've got some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and we'll be resuming our two-part special, Glastonbury Abbey's Sphere of Influence, Part 2, next week. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Sed veni.